The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Merkle Media.
Start looking at people like they don't matter. I'm waking up to the fact, more than a little bit shallow. I'm lost, I miss home, but I don't wanna. I'm lost, I miss home, 'cause I'm just trying to
good, everybody. This is Joel Thomas, and this is Free the Rabbits. And how are all the free range rabbits doing out there today? First off, I want to say thank you to everyone who's been giving a 5-star review. It has really helped the show grow because it allows the show to get deeper into the algorithm so people that don't normally get a hold of the show can get a hold of the show. So, in saying that, if you've been listening to the show and you haven't given a 5-star review, please go do that now before we even get started. And if you're new to the show, well, listen to the show first. And if you feel like it deserves a 5-star review, please give it a 5-star review at the end of the show. Also, for people who have been asking how they can donate to the show, well, there's a couple of ways. First, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/freetherabbits. You can give a one-time donation there, or you can set yourself up for a monthly donation. Also, you can go to YouTube, where we have YouTube memberships. We have 3 different tiers. We have Nephilim Portal Baby, Nephilim Hunter, and Good Nephilim. All 3 of those have a few different options, but they all come with custom emojis that you can use in the comments and use in the live chats. Again, I really appreciate you guys helping the show grow in any way that you can, even if it's just donating your time. And now, let's get into the show. What's up, guys? We are back with the final episode, the 3rd part of our 3-part series of Agent Crowley, Hidden Father of MK Ultra. And today we will finally connect Aleister Crowley to the MK Ultra program and how that his experiments from 1900 to 1919 were directly connected to not only MK Ultra, but Nazi testing during World War II. And it all trickles down because if you know anything about some of the guys that were doing some of the awful testing for Germany during World War II, they were brought over to work for the United States as a part of Operation Paperclip. So all this connects. All this is going to connect. And as a matter of fact, there's one central key figure who worked on some of the testing for MKUltra programming, and he has a huge link to Aleister Crowley as well. Now, if you'll remember episode one, we got really into Aleister Crowley's connection to the Divine Cactus, the mezcal buttons, peyote, and what his relationship was to it, and some of the characters like Charles Henry Allen Bennett, George S. Davis, James Mooney, Dr. Silas Weir Mitchell, and William Butler Yeats, who he was a part of the Golden Dawn with, and their connection to bringing peyote to Crowley's attention. But as we've dug into on episode two, Crowley had a connection to peyote long before to them. They just helped bring more of the shared light to it. And in episode two, we talked about his direct link to his ritual practices, specifically when he wrote Liber 418 with Victor Newberg in the desert. And this is when he was said to have crossed into the third grade of the AA, and he went to the City of the Pyramids, where he communed with the secret chiefs, and it altered his life from then on. Now, that's important because we will talk a little bit about ritual practices, and that's a big part of MKUltra too. So it's not just this peyote experimentation that Crowley had been doing, but also the ritual practices. And we will talk about a loose connection there, but mainly this is about his peyote testing with up to 100 subjects. And we'll talk about how that we actually know about this from Crowley's own mouth. But before we get directly into MKUltra, I do want to talk about Liber Legis, the Book of the Law, and how that particular book in 1904 was written with Crowley and Rose Edith Kelly experimenting on peyote. Now, we don't have this directly out of Crowley's mouth. Obviously, he wrote a lot of blinds and hidden messages, which you talked about on episode two, throughout all of his works. And the Book of the Law is no different. And I'm going to break down now how that works. And once we get through this Book of the Law and how that it was written while he was on peyote, while he was communing with ayahuasca, that's very important because we're going to correlate it to a couple of his works later on. And we're going to show how he had been experimenting with this divine cactus since his time in Mexico in 1900. And that's important because it shows how long he'd been experimenting with this particular drug and the fact that he was experimenting on and with other people, which plays right into him being a secret agent of British intelligence. And once we get through the Book of the Law part, we will talk about briefly his time as a secret agent here in the States and how that connects directly to MKUltra. So to get to Cairo in the Book of the Law, Crowley would have no difficulty finding hashish there. And we know that he was experimenting with hashish. We know that there were several times that he said he had reached the state of samadhi while he was using hashish, but he didn't prefer it. And we do know that peyote was the drug of choice to be able to do that. However, veiled and as many blinds as he threw out throughout his writings. But that was a huge part of him connecting to these praetor humans, these secret chiefs. So if he did peyote in Cairo, he would have had to bring his own supply. And he could have easily done that from Mexico. And we talked about in the last episode, his time in Mexico and the experimenting that, from all indications, he was doing there. So to bring these mezcal buttons, they're only a few centimeters in diameter, and they maintain their potency for decades. And we talked about this. You can dry them out, and they'll last forever. And he could have easily fit them in a small cigar box. And we know about the smuggling of mezcal buttons in cigar boxes, which was very similar when Briggs was bringing the mezcal buttons to Parke Davis, which Parke Davis was the company that created the extract that Crowley preferred later on. So it would have been easy for him to smuggle these mezcal buttons into Cairo. As a matter of fact, especially during that particular time period, you could smuggle a lot. It's nothing like it is now. So that would have been a very easy way for him to smuggle these mezcal buttons into Cairo for he and Rose Edith Kelly to be able to use during the writing or automatic writing by Iowas through Crowley of Liber Legis, the Book of the Law. And we know that he is just coming off being in Mexico. In Mexico, he completed two of the visions that were needed for Liber 418. And we do know later on with Victor Newberg in 1909 that he completed the other 28. So he completed the 30 aethers, and at that point is when he crossed over into the City of the Pyramids. And he even stated in Magic and Theory and Practice on page 8, he said, "Somebody who is nobody in particular goes away for a longer or shorter period and comes back as a great medicine man, but nobody ever knows exactly what happened to him." So this is playing right into him coming out of Mexico. And I did read this phrase earlier in episode 1. But this is what he thought, and he's not wrong. There are so many different historical figures who created religions or created cult followings that go away for a period of time, come back, and they just have these epiphanies like they spoke to something out in the wilderness. But to get to how that the Book of the Law could have been written on peyote, it's all in the blinds. It's all in the hidden messaging. So in diary entries for 1904 Cairo events, they're very fragmented and really obscure to find, but he put deliberate blinds in these diaries at a time as an act of spite against himself. They contain bizarre codes, which Crowley described as unintelligible blinds, and such as the following series of entries, which I'm going to read. February 11th saw BFG. Then it just says BFB. Then March 22nd. XPB, EPD in 84M, which trouble with DS, PB. So it looks like a jumbled bunch of nonsense, right? And for anyone reading this, they could have taken it as Crowley was trying to insult them, which he did a lot of times in his writings. We can look to the Book of Lies, which you talked about last episode too. But if we're going to consider that Crowley was a secret agent, then we have to consider that these entries actually meant something. So if we look at what these could have meant when it comes to mescaline and peyote, there are two of the entries that I mentioned, XPB and PB. So the first XPB, if we're looking at Roman numerals, could mean 10 peyote buttons and then peyote buttons respectively. So these unintelligible blinds could actually mean everything. But again, that can mean nothing too, but I'm going to show why that him writing that during that period of time is going to directly correlate to this idea of him being on mescaline while he was talking to Iowas to write this Book of the Law. So if we go back to when Crowley attempted to contact Abaldiz in 1911 and Amalastra in 1918, the way he modeled those operations were of his 1904 ceremonies in Cairo which he invoked Horus and contacted Iowas. And the methods Crowley's used to test the visions of his seers in 1911 and 1918 were based on the methods he used in 1904 to test Rose. So you remember we talked about how the Scarlet Woman, whoever that was at the time, he would speak to her, the seer, to the entity that was speaking through her, and he would lay out specific coded questions to the entity that only he and the entity would know. Now, she would repeat it back, but she would have no idea what Crowley was saying. That way, he knew if the entity was real or she was lying, or if the entity itself was good or evil, which is funny because it was all evil. So the 1904 testing took place around the same time period of the time marked in the diary codes XPB and PB. So this is how we know that, okay, we know that he used to write in blinds. We know he used to write secret codes. He's doing this at the exact time while the rituals in Cairo were happening when he wrote his most important work, which was the basis of Thelema. And we know that both sex and drugs were used to obtain the visionary contact to the entities Abaldiz and Amalantra. So if he modeled those two workings after the working that he did in Cairo, it would make sense that if he was using sex and drugs on the other two, which were later, then he would have used sex and drugs during the 1904 Cairo workings. We have to put that correlation together. But he never actually wrote about doing any sex magic or doing any drugs while in Cairo, which is very interesting. However, after he died, there was a published manuscript of a tarot divination performed in Cairo that states the ritual is of sex. So this came later after he died, and it was obvious that, okay, he stated that there was sex involved, but that was way later. Initially, he never said anything about it. And if he was using the fluid extract of peyote in the workings with Abaldiz and Amalantra, then he would have known that those would have Cairo when he was talking to Iowas to write this book of the law. And we're talking about how he tested his scarlet women or these seers that he was with. He actually tested Rose Edith Kelly, and we know about their famous visit to the Cairo Museum when she took him to the Stele of Revealing. And if we want to suggest that he was on drugs and using sex magic in the latter two, which he said was based on the former in 1904, then we have to suggest that he and Rose Edith Kelly were both on peyote when they went into this museum. And the way that he tested Rose Edith Kelly, he wanted to test her ability to recognize Horus. So he escorted her to the Cairo Museum and challenged her to pick out Horus's image. So secretly, he was happy because Rose walked through the museum and passed several images of Horus. So he's thinking, oh, this is just full of crap. She's not telling me the truth, or this entity's trying to lie to me. So he thinks he's got something going. But they came up to the painted wooden funeral stela of the Theban priest Ankh-Fen-Khonsu. Rose stopped and exclaimed, "There he is." Now the stela depicted a relatively obscure form of Horus. Most importantly, though, the tag that was on the display, the exhibit number was the number 666, the number of the beast. So he knew that she was telling the truth. She knew that this entity was guiding her to this obscure stele that had Horus on it, and the exhibit number was 666. So at that point, he was all in. So the other tie-in to Liber Legis being written while he was on peyote is in the Kabbalistic values or the gematria that's connected to it. And again, for people that want to know, I'm not a big gematria guy. I do appreciate people that understand it and want to dig deep into it. I understand how it works enough, but I am not the type of guy that's going to be looking for someone walking across the street on the news and pointing out something in the background and turning it into some gematria madness. And I'm not saying that some of this stuff that we see isn't presented to us as psyops, but I'm here to tell you now, everything ain't fake. And it does bother me when I see people that constantly, all they do all day long is try to find gematria in every little thing. And I promise you, if you try to find it, you'll find it. It won't make a lot of sense, but you'll throw out a bunch of gibberish and numbers and people will be like, oh my God. But do I believe in numerology and gematria? Absolutely. And I think these high-level occultists build a lot of their practices on it. And after Crowley received Liber Legis, he discovered that the ancient Greek words for will, thelema, and love, agape, shared the same Kabbalistic value, 93. To him, it seemed to confirm the equivalence of both will and love asserted by the thelemic doctrine, which, I'm going to give you the two central principles of thelema, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law, and love is the law, love under will. So this is where those two phrases are broke down into this Kabbalistic value of 93. Now, Crowley took this as an indication that Iwas possessed a knowledge of Kabbalah far superior to his own. He also discovered that Iwas was actually a Hebrew name, and it too had the numeric value of 93. So the number 93 came to have a huge significance to Crowley, and it expressed the dual aspects of the law of thelema, and it also represented his HGA, or Holy Guardian Angel, who delivered that law to him. And 93 became the magical code for both thelema and Iwas, and he often abbreviated the phrase, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law, as 93, and the phrase, love is the law, love under will, as 93 divided by 93. And you'll see that with people that follow thelema or thelemites. And a lot of times they'll greet each other with 93. That's part of what they do. So in 1916, Charles Stansfield Jones, or C.S. Jones, who was his magical child, and we've talked about this before, he performed his own Kabbalistic analysis of Liber Legis and discovered that the number 31 was a key to many of the most cryptic verses in the text. And we know that 31 is the value of the Hebrew words A-L, which means God, and L-A, which means not. According to Crowley, this key revealed a whole new dimension of meaning in Liber Legis. He actually wrote to Jones and said, your key opens palace. Liber Legis is unfolded like a flower. So let's take that into account. The flower, we know that on the peyote cactus, the flower is what people will pick and ingest to go on these missions to invoke their spirit guides. So I thought that was fascinating when I heard him talk about the flower. Also, the keys that Jones discovered, AL and 31, were what? We talked about this last episode. Crowley's private magical codes for peyote. And for 15 years, Crowley had always called his magnum opus either Liber Legis or Liber L, or the Book of the Law. But after 1919, after Jones came to him with this discovery, Crowley began referring to Liber Legis as Liber AL or Liber AL Vel Legis. And if that's not one of the biggest connections between the Book of the Law being written while he was on peyote, that was one of his codes. That was one of his blinds, 31. If you'll remember, we talked about, depending on who the Scarlet Woman was at the time, he would use 31 to speak to the entity on whether she or he needed to be on peyote during any of the workings they were doing. That was his secret code for peyote, because AL stands for what? Anilonium Lewini, which was the archaic name for peyote at the time, which we no longer use. But at the time, that's what Crowley would have meant it for. So this AL in Liber AL would be Anilonium Lewini, 31. And it makes perfect sense because the technical title for Liber Legis is also Liber 31. And was this a discovery that Jones himself discovered while he was on peyote? We have to throw that out there too. Shortly after this discovery by Jones, Crowley announced his plan to publish Liber 934, The Cactus, a whole book about peyote. Now, I'm not going to talk about that yet because I want to get to some of his secret missions that he was doing in the United States and how this actually comes up. And I'm going to read what Crowley says about Liber 934 and what significance that is to the entire basis of MK Ultra programming. So the book that he planned to publish, called Liber 934, The Cactus, which was completely about peyote, which, by the way, never got written, and I'm going to get to that later. The significance of those numbers plays into the diary of Crowley's attempt to give up cocaine and heroin, which also mentions peyote, is Liber 93, which is very important. Also, the planned book on peyote, The Cactus, is called Liber 934, which we talked about. The significance of 93 was already what I just talked about. And we already know that 4 was the number of magic, Crowley's book of instructions for the brothers. So after 1919, we find Crowley renaming Liber Legis, the central text of Thelema, after the magical codes he used for peyote. And at the same time, he began tagging important works about drugs and peyote with his magical code for Thelema. So he completely changed the name of the Book of the Law after C.S. Jones came to him with his visions of 31. And at this point, he decides he's going to come out with an entire book about his secret experiments of the divine cactus called Liber 934. And if you think about it, we talked about this before, Crowley only appears to have used 31 as a code for peyote in his diaries of magical operations, intended for what? To talk to praetor humans. So anytime he's used 31 in any writings, he's talking about what? Peyote. So why would he change the name of his most important work? Liber Legis, Liber 31 is what he changed it to. Liber Al, Liber Al. It's because that was a acknowledgement to an adept that could understand that I need to be on these drugs to connect to these entities. And what's super odd about Liber Legis is it stands out literally as the lone exception in a long, long list of magical ceremonies that Crowley did with multiple people spanning almost 2 decades that we know of. And they all show a consistent pattern of him using sex and drugs, but this lone entry, Liber Legis, Liber 31, Liber AL, the Book of the Law, his most important work, he just doesn't talk about it at all. Not once. Doesn't talk about sex or drugs to achieve this. Now, we talked about in the last episode why he might want to do that, why that this holy guardian angel, the most important entity that he had ever talked to in his whole life, how he would want people to view that he did this without the use of sex, magic, and drugs. But clearly, he's letting us know by changing the name to 31, he's letting the adepts know that, no, I did, just like everything else. Because everything else was built on that. So why would he not do it in the most important work of his life, and then all of a sudden, everything else, which he said was built on it, he did the opposite? Doesn't make sense. But again, I'm just bringing up all this crazy, hidden language that he put out as a showcase of how Crowley would operate as a secret agent, not only with the occult, but with British intelligence. And if we really want to go deep about Crowley and drug usage and the people that he was around, just think about the number of individuals that he was either friends with or acquaintances with or people he was in secret societies with who were all chemists or somehow connected to pharmaceuticals. George Cecil Jones in the Golden Dawn was an industrial chemist by profession. Julian L. Baker, who introduced Crowley to Jones, was a highly accomplished and well-respected chemist. Alan Bennett, who we talked about, who taught Crowley the right art of magic, introduced him to pharmacological assisted ceremonial techniques, and he was an analytic chemist by profession. Oscar Eckenstein, and he, we talked about in the very first Agent Crowley episode I ever did about his time in Mexico, He joined Crowley in 1900 in Mexico, and they climbed mountains together. He taught him techniques of concentration, and he once worked as a chemist. Edward Winery, who contributed to the Equinox, supplied Crowley with hashish and fluid extract or peyote, and he was a highly regarded chemist in London. Kenneth Martin Ward, one of Crowley's first AA students, entered Cambridge University on a physics and chemistry scholarship. And we can keep going down the line. That's just a small handful. Almost everyone he surrounded himself with were chemists by trade. So you have to ask yourself, if not only for the connection to these praetor humans that he was trying to achieve, what was all this, what were all these connections to all of these chemists? What was the purpose when he was working with British intelligence for what we can guesstimate most of his adult life? There had to be a component. We have to think about this now. There had to be a component that the intelligence department wanted to find out some sort of information when it came to the usage of these psychedelics and these other pharmaceuticals. And I would venture to say this, and I know that sometimes people, when we suggest that Aleister Crowley was a secret agent, we really look at the geopolitical side. We really look at the controlling of the human mind through drugs, and that plays into the whole MKUltra part, right? But what about secret intelligence interest in praetor humans? Come on now. We know modern governments are highly interested in these interdimensional beings. We know last year during the congressional hearings with David Grush, where he talked about that they're not extraterrestrial, they're interdimensional. So why would they not have been interested as far back as then? We know throughout history, all kind of ancient governments were connected to the quote unquote gods. Well, why wouldn't they be then as well? We know the Nazis were deep into the occult. We know that Adolf was deep into the occult. This was the precursor to that. All these governments are interested in it. So I would venture to say that they were also interested in Crowley's connection to these praetor humans as well. So now to jump to Crowley's secret agent activity in the United States. And we're going to get directly to the Parke Davis fluid extract that he went to get in Detroit. We're going to talk about how he went through Detroit. And this is where we're going to really nail down the book, The Cactus, and explain to you what he was doing. And then we're going to slide right into MKUltra programming and how it all connects. But to get there, though, we have to start with a guy called Gustav Konstantin von Alvensleben. And he was a German entrepreneur, and he was based in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, and Seattle, Washington. It's important that he was the Seattle, Washington part, because this is where Crowley comes in. So Gustav, and he was better known as Alvo, he was the wandering son of a Prussian junker family. Now, he landed in British Columbia in 1904. He had nothing to his name. He was the classic rags to riches in a few years. By 1914, he was a celebrity and millionaire controlling huge investments in timber, land, and coal. Much of Alvo's success stemmed from his secret role as a front man for a syndicate of big German investors. And he was also, shocker, prominent Freemason. And some people think that he was also part of the OTO as well, which would have connected him directly to Aleister Crowley, because Crowley was in the States and he was trying to set up the OTO specifically in Detroit. So that brings also in the Parke Davis extract of peyote, because he wasn't just going there for that, but he had a whole other reason too, because he was trying to set up the OTO there, and he had Charles Stansfield Jones staying there while Crowley would pop in and out. Now, on the advent of World War One, Alvo, his activity started to look suspicious to Canada, and he was on his way back from Berlin when the war broke out. So he stayed safely on the American side of the border. Now, the issue is that Alvo had all of his assets in Canada, cash, bonds, artworks, and he wouldn't go retrieve it because he was too worried about Canadian authorities arresting him. So the connection between him and Crowley was Alvo's business interest gave him access to numerous bank accounts and financial institutions, which he used to launder and move German funds. Chicago became Alvo's main base of clandestine operations, and he was a close friend of Chicago consul von Reiswich, who was said to have invited Crowley to a special gathering at New York's German Club. And because he was tight with Alvo, it suggested that Alvo and Crowley met during that time. Also, Crowley noted in some of his writings many years later that Frau von Alvensleben was Alvo's Canadian-born wife, was one of Crowley's devotees, and she followed the teachings of Crowley. So that also gives another big connection. So the thought pattern is that Crowley was going to Vancouver. He was taking his way on a train, going through all these places to get to Vancouver to do some OTO business up there. And this is, he was meeting C.S. Jones up there. But the idea is that the secret agent side of Crowley was sent to go up there, retrieve a lot of Alvo's money, paintings, just belongings that Alvo, he himself couldn't go up there and get. Because you do know that Crowley, when he left there, he went back down through the Seattle area. So it would have made sense that he would have gone up there to do that. Again, this is all part of Crowley's secret agent side, even though in his writings he talks specifically about his occult workings. This is the other part of it. And it's not like Crowley wouldn't have gotten paid for that. As a matter of fact, before his departure, he noted a receipt of a chunk of cash. It was by far the largest amount he had handled in some time. So that was his traveling money, quote unquote. And it's thought that Alvo was the one that sent him this money because he wanted Crowley to procure his belongings. So Crowley left with Jean Robert Foster and her husband, which was important because Crowley was definitely having relations with a lot of different women who had husbands, generally very young, beautiful model type women who had very old, rich, wealthy husbands. And this was no different because the sickly and over 60-year-old Matlock Foster, her husband, would have needed to go with her because during that particular time, they had what they called the Mann Act, and it made it a federal offense to transport a woman across state lines for any quote-unquote unlawful purpose, which would have also included adultery. So they would have needed the old man to go with them. And who knows? They could have been drugging him up. He might have been too old and been falling asleep while they were doing whatever. And Jean Robert Foster was super deep into theosophy. She was also a disciple of Aleister Crowley, and she was also known by her magical name, Sister Hilarion. And she was tight with William Butler Yeats as well, which Crowley was no longer tight with. So they go on this trip. They're all leaving to go up to the OTO up in Vancouver. And during this journey back and forth across North America, Crowley's super vague in his writings. We don't really know what he was doing. We know where he was stopping. We know what he said he was going to do, but there was just major gaps. And I've talked about this since I started this Agent Crowley series. Monstrous gaps all the time. There might be 3 months missing, or there'll be a sentence here, sentence there, nothing, and there'll be some gibberish, or what we think would be gibberish if you don't understand what the blinds are that he's giving you, the hidden verbiage. And again, I don't always think that the hidden verbiage was just about the occult. I think the hidden verbiage could have very well also been a hidden language for British secret intelligence or whatever intelligence agencies he was working with. I think he was working for several. Double, triple agent. We know that he was doing it with the Germans in the United States anyway. I have no doubt that he was working also with American intelligence behind the scenes. We know of multiple documents that the FBI, CIA says that, oh, we don't have anything for you. We don't know. They know. They know. And I believe that he was also working for them. So to get to this MK Ultra connection, we're right here. I had to set up the tone, why he was going to Vancouver, what he said he was doing, what he also possibly was doing with Alvo, all these different storylines going at once. I feel like it's a Marvel movie in the multiverse. So many different things that Crowley's got his hands in, so many things we don't really know if he had his hands in or not. But with the info that we have, this is the best ideas that we have of what he was doing. So 10 days en route to Vancouver, Crowley visited at least three American cities. We talked about Detroit, Chicago. We talked about Alvo's connections in Chicago and Minneapolis, St. Paul. Again, this is all he talked about that he stopped at. I think he made way more stops than that, but this is all that we know from his writings that he did. So his biggest errand in the Motor City, besides trying to get the OTO set up and put the feelers out, he visited the Park Davis Pharmaceutical Plant, and he gets there and there's mass production of pills and potions. He was like, this is what I'm looking for. But his real goal was to score a big stash of pharmaceutically refined peyote. And also, we talked about the Rites of Artemis or Eleusis. He drugged the audiences there with the performance that he did, which we talked about on last episode. So he's always very familiar. Again, he's testing people. He's testing what the drug does to people. And he said he appreciated the drug's ability to generate profound altered states of consciousness. And again, he's headed his way to Vancouver to meet all these people that are part of the OTO there. They're looking for their prophet to come. Of course, he's going to bring something to test them with, to help them achieve samadhi, to connect to praetor humans. But I would even go as far as to say he was experimenting on them via British secret intelligence. And from that moment, 18 years later, and I brought this up earlier, Nazi doctors at the Dachau concentration camp gave massive mescaline doses to prisoners in hope of achieving chemical hypnosis. British interrogators dabbled with the same drug during World War II. The result of these and like experiments was the drug could amplify the effectiveness of interrogation techniques it properly administered. After World War II, the U.S. Navy's Operation Chatter continued to experiment with mescaline as a speech-inducing agent. The same and related psychedelics featured prominently in the CIA's secret MK-Ultra mind control projects, which flourished throughout the 1950s and 1960s. So this is it. This is that connection I was trying to tell you. So Crowley is the precursor to all of these tests. And we know from the last two episodes, Crowley was a pioneer in this crazy field. He was one of the first Europeans to get a hold of peyote and its uses. He experimented on himself first. Then he experimented on other people. And if he's a secret agent, do you not think that this is getting verbalized back to his superiors? Of course it is. And his groundbreaking work may have informed some of these later experiments that we talked about. MK Ultra, Operation Chatter, what the Nazis were doing with mescaline, with chemical hypnosis. He even said, I have myself made extensive and elaborate studies of the effects of indulgence in stimulants and narcotics. And he said he produced a vast quantity of unpublished data on the subject. Did he now? Was it unpublished? Of course it was unpublished. Didn't mean it wasn't written down. Didn't mean it didn't get shifted to intelligence agencies behind the scenes. And during his American stay, the Beast routinely administered mescaline or other drugs to willing and unsuspecting subjects. I want to throw that out there. We talked about the Rites of Eleusis. We talked about the Rites of Artemis. We talked about how he was doing it to unsuspecting people that were coming to watch him perform these rituals as like a, best way to say it, like a performance, a play. So he's all very familiar with that. And he methodically cataloged all these results. And these observations ended up in another one of his journals. And we just talked about this, Liber 934, The Cactus, which he described as an elaborate study of the psychological effects produced by Anolonium Lewini, compiled from the actual records of some hundreds of experiments. Cactus vanished after the war, and I'm going to get into that in a little more detail here in a second. And he wrote a short fictional story which was not fictional, but fictional, quotations. The drug, which I spoke about, I believe in episode one, I might have touched on in episode two. It was originally published in Great Britain in the January 1909 issue of The Idler. And it's one of his earliest published short stories and highlights his power as an author of fiction as well as poetry. And it's one of the first fictionalized accounts of ingesting an hallucinogenic substance. And most people think it is based on Crowley's own experiences with Anilonium Lewini or peyote. And this short story precursor, The Drug, and the experiments that came after seem to be the basis for Liber 934, The Cactus. Now, to get into The Cactus, there's not a lot about it, guys, but there's enough for us to put the correlation to what he was actually doing with peyote this whole time, not only to connect to these praetor humans and achieve samadhi and move to a level of ascending and enlightenment that he wanted to do personally, but I believe that he was experimenting on people via what British secret intelligence was asking him to do. So The Cactus is a record of experiments with mescal buttons. There's no known copy that exists, so most people think it was just a collection of case study documents destroyed by British customs. In a letter from Crowley to Gerald York, who was also a member of the AA, Crowley wrote a suggestion that the loss to customs might have also been due in some fashion to Norman Mud. The Cactus was never written. This is Crowley's words. What existed was a package containing something like 100 records of people who had experimented with Anilonium Lewini, and this package was sunk into mud, M-U-D-D, was destroyed by customs when crates of missives were sent from Cefalu. And Crowley says, to court to wash all the dirty linen of the GD, Golden Dawn. At this point, he's on the outs. This is when they dissolve. He's got no love for him. It is never any good asking a writer who is not a publisher's hack to chop his books about. Self-respecting authors won't do it, especially when they have no clear idea as to what is actually wanted. How can they have? They have already written the book with a certain idea in mind, and you cannot expect them to write some book which is not theirs at all. I have no objection to publishing the whole of the AA instructions, preferably in a cheap and popular form. He says, The Cactus was never written. What existed was a package containing something like 100 records of people who had experimented with Anilonium Lewini, and this package was sunk into mud. So he's basically saying that Norman Mud sunk it in customs. He said, I think Ogden and Earp might like Liber Aleph as it is very literary. The urn is simply a magical diary, which I talked about the urn on the last episode. So Crowley specifically tells Gerald York in a letter to him that the book that he was going to write, The Cactus, that the package containing the 100 records of experiments that he did on people were destroyed by customs. British customs, which I don't believe at all. If he was a secret agent for British intelligence, I believe that he gave them to them. These were experiments that he was supposed to do. I believe that he wanted to write a book about them, but I believe, and this is just me theorizing here, that British intelligence didn't want him putting this info out. I think his culmination was to tell people how these experiments work. I think he wanted people, the adepts that followed under him in the AA, to read this and use the information to achieve samadhi, to get connection to these praetor humans. Obviously, I think when he wrote it, he would have written it with tons of hidden verbiage and blinds, and I don't think it would have been something that the average person could have picked up and understood. But these experiments, 100 records were snatched up by, at least we know, by the British. Now, I think he handed it over to them. Now, it's possible that he refused to do it, and then they ended up getting a hold of it, and they figured out where it was going to be and ended up taking it. That's also a possibility. That's also another theory. But what we do know is that Crowley stated that he had 100 records of experiments that he did on people using peyote. And we have to think that this was something connected to British intelligence. And I jump into MK Ultra, For people that don't know, again, just brief overview of MK Ultra, and we're going to get to a central figure that's tied directly to MK Ultra and Aleister Crowley, and this is going to bring around full circle. Not only do we know that Crowley was doing experiments on people verbatim by his own mouth in this mysterious cactus that never got written, but 100 records, but also we have a figure who also essentially worshiped Crowley and was a huge part of MKUltra. Now, MKUltra was a human experimentation program designed and undertaken by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency to develop procedures and identify drugs that could be used during interrogations to weaken individuals and force confessions through brainwashing and psychological torture. MKUltra began in 1953 and was halted in 1973. I think that's a big joke. I don't think they stopped after 20 years. I think they kept going. They just rolled it under different programs, different black sites, and the like. They didn't stop. They said they stopped. And Bill Clinton apologized for it when he was president. But it's funny that he apologized for that later in the 90s. And why are you apologizing now, Bill? Because you're still doing it? Come on. I love people that think the government's changed. Oh, they used to do that. They stopped doing it. Well, they just got caught and they rebranded it. It's hidden. Come on, guys. Come on. Now, MKUltra was preceded by Project Artichoke, and it was initially known as Project Bluebird. Project Artichoke arose on August 20th, 1951, and was operated by the CIA's Office of Scientific Intelligence. And their primary goal was to determine whether a person could be involuntarily made to perform an act of attempted assassination, kind of like a Manchurian candidate. The project also studied the effects of mind control and hypnosis, forced addiction to morphine and other chemicals, including LSD, and to produce amnesia in other vulnerable states in victims. And we know that MKUltra was so much larger than just that. We're just getting into the drug side of it. There are multiple other sides of it. We know that there's a sexual component to it, an abuse component to it. There's a ritualistic component to it. And I will tie Crowley into the ritualistic part a little bit at the end. In 1977, a Freedom of Information Act request uncovered a cache of 20,000 documents relating to MKUltra, which led to Senate hearings. Some surviving information about MKUltra was declassified in 2001. As a matter of fact, you can go look at all these documents online, literally 20,000 documents. I've looked through some, not 20,000. That's a huge undertaking, and that's not really my cup of tea to go down that road per se. Now, if I'm looking for specific documents to tie into MKUltra, I'll go try to find those. Now, we talked about earlier, during the early 1940s, Nazi scientists working in the concentration camps of Auschwitz and Dachau during World War II conducted interrogation experiments on human subjects. And we know they use barbiturates, morphine, hallucinogens, and mescaline. So this is the precursor to MKUltra. And we talked about this because what Crowley would have done with his experiments would have trickled into the Nazi scientists with connections behind the scenes. We know that there were British people in governments that were sympathizers to the Nazi movement. It's not like there wouldn't have been that connection there as well. We can track those. There's plenty of those. And this was the precursor to this information getting to the CIA. Again, Operation Paperclip. And we know in 1938, Albert Hofmann at the Sandoz Laboratories in Basel, Switzerland, and he was the Swiss chemist known for being the first to synthesize, ingest, and learn of the psychedelic effects of LSD. The early directors of MKUltra became aware of the existence of LSD and sought to use it for mind control. In the early 1950s, MKUltra director Sidney Gottlieb arranged for the CIA to buy the entire supply of LSD for $240,000, which in 2024, as of last year, would be a little over $4 million. And the supply gave Gottlieb the ability to fulfill his experiment by spreading LSD to prisons, hospitals, institutions, clinics, and foundations in order to see how the citizens would react to the drug without knowing exactly what was happening to them. So again, a lot of MKUltra was done to unsuspecting victims. You can even go to Operation Midnight Climax. This is when the CIA set up several brothels within agency safe houses. This is wild. In San Francisco to obtain a selection of men who would be too embarrassed to talk about the events. The men were dosed with LSD, the brothels were equipped with one-way mirrors, and the sessions were filmed for later viewing and study. In other experiments where people were given LSD without their knowledge, they were interrogated under bright lights with doctors in the background taking notes. They told the subjects they would extend their quote-unquote trips if they refused to reveal their secrets, as in LSD trips. The people under this interrogation were CIA employees, U.S. military personnel, and agents suspected of working for the other side in the Cold War. So they were bringing these men in, these fake brothels, and they were dosing up with LSD and doing experiments to them. And you have to wonder, in Crowley's time, these 100 records that he said he had, how much of that was started there? We know Crowley was deeply entrenched in sex magic, and Crowley was bisexual. Crowley could have done it to either sex, and I think that was a huge part of the allure that British intelligence had with him. He was just super amoral and could go anywhere and do anything, and he had no qualms about it. Kill anybody. He had no moral code. Even though he said he did, he really had no moral code. It's all based in do what thou wilt is the whole of the law. Do what thou wilt. So to get to the connection, right? We just talked about prisons. We talked about hospitals, institutions where people were unsuspectedly given LSD for testing. We got to talk about Timothy Leary. He was an American psychologist and author known for his strong advocacy of psychedelic drugs. And most people think he's pretty polarizing. Some people think he's like a bold oracle, and some people think he's a publicity hound. I think he's a little of both, in my honest opinion. Allen Ginsberg said he was the hero of American consciousness, and he was just a huge, huge person that pushed the counterculture movement in the 1960s and 1970s, which I believe that counterculture movement was fabricated by the CIA the entire time. And I think that Leary was a huge part of this. Yeah, he was a clinical psychologist at Harvard University, and he founded the Harvard Psilocybin Project after he revealed his experience with magic mushrooms he had in Mexico in 1960. And so for years, he tested this. As a matter of fact, this trickled all the way to Concord Prison for the Concord Prison Experiment. And this is when Leary evaluated the use of psilocybin and psychotherapy in the rehabilitation of released prisoners. 36 prisoners were reported to have repented and sworn off criminality after Leary and his associates guided them through the psychedelic experience. And they said the overall rate for the American prisoners was 60% during this project that Leary did through magic mushrooms. Now, just a little bit later on, Leary met up with Richard Albert, was also known as Baba Ram Dass, and he was an American spiritual teacher, guru of modern yoga, psychologist, and writer. And they worked together at Harvard, where they were essentially giving their students psychedelics, and they were taking it with them, and they were doing it all in the name of experimentation. The Harvard Center for Research in Personality raised concerns about it, and they wrote about it in the Harvard Crimson, and it led the university to halt the experiments. But Leary and Alpert continued with the experiments, and they both ended up getting fired for it. So after that happened is when it seems to be that Timothy Leary, who was a huge part of this counterculture movement, the quote-unquote hippie movement, and people who were against the government, which was all manufactured by the government, by the way. Timothy Leary was a big part of this. And he said about LSD, nothing can happen with LSD if it's used crudely or for power or manipulative purposes. That was him in 1966, which I think is ironic because it's the complete opposite of what he says later. And Leary was handpicked from all indications, and obviously you got to do some research because some people think that Leary was on the outside, but he specifically, and I'm going to show you today where he specifically talks about the CIA and working with them. And this was during the time of MK Ultra. And he was all about the experiments they were doing, even though he came off as this counterculture against the government guy, very much like Crowley. And I'm going to show you the connection with him and Crowley too here in a second. They come off as these counterculture anarchists against the government, but they're still working for the government. Now, I think it's one and the same. I think they are anti-government in the ways that they're saying, but I think they know for them to operate the way they want to, they work with the government and they talk good about the government. Now, Leary was a little more vocal in the public talking good about the CIA later on in his life, whereas you never heard that from Crowley, but in veiled parts of his writings. And Timothy Leary was a huge part of this drug revolution in the 1950s and 60s. And during Project MK Ultra, during this period of CIA interest in LSD-funded research, Timothy Leary received 8 government grants from 1953 to 1958, most coming from the National Institute of Mental Health, which is now known for being a CIA front for MK Ultra programming. So he was receiving money from the CIA to do experiments at the National Institute of Mental Health, where it was a front for CIA MK Ultra programming. So he's for sure doing it. As a matter of fact, Leary says, the LSD movement was started by CIA. He legit says this. I wouldn't be here now without the foresight of the CIA scientists. It was no accident. It was all planned and scripted by Central Intelligence. I'm in favor of Central Intelligence. He's telling you right there. It's all for it. He's getting paid by them to do what they wanted. And again, he got arrested. He did jail time. I think he went off the rails. I don't think it was just he was for the government. Again, I think some of these guys have their own agendas. I think Crowley had his own agenda, but he worked with the government because it allowed them to operate more easily with what they really were trying to achieve. And I think Crowley's real achievements were in the occult world, but he was so good at becoming a double, triple agent and working for British intelligence that it allowed him to operate the way he wanted to. I just think Leary went off the rails later, but again, he still talked highly about the CIA. And you got to think the youth of the 1960s who were all against the government welcomed Leary with open arms. And they looked at him as the spiritual development and psychological growth of Americans when it came to drugs like LSD. And this is the big connection. We've got Crowley with all the experiments that he did early on, which trickled down into Nazi Germany, which trickled into Operation Paperclip, which subsequently trickled into MK Ultra. We have that part of it, but we've also got Leary, who is literally entrenched in MK Ultra programming, working on experimenting on these people. And Leary idolized Aleister Crowley. He believed he was carrying on the famous work of Aleister Crowley. And this is actually on video of Leary saying, I have been an admirer of Aleister Crowley. I think I'm carrying on much of the work he started over 100 years ago. I think even the 60s themselves. What? What work are you carrying on, Leary? We could say occult. We could say magical practices. But that's not what Leary's known for. And this isn't what Leary's talking about. Leary says, you know, Crowley said he was in favor of finding your own self and do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. This is out of Leary's mouth. He knew. He knew that Crowley was the precursor to all of these drug experiments that ended up being MKUltra. And to get just a little bit into ritualistic sacrificial practices in MKUltra, we know about sexual abuse, all of these things. In Magic and Theory and Practice, which we've talked about this book already in the series, Crowley talks about animal and human sacrifice. He says, for the highest spiritual working, one must accordingly choose that victim which contains the greatest and purest force. A male child of perfect innocence and high intelligence is the most satisfactory and suitable victim. But the bloody sacrifice, though more dangerous, is more efficacious. And for nearly all purposes, human sacrifice is the best. So he's literally breaking down human sacrifice. He's really talking about another side to this MK Ultra. I mean, what kind of spiritual growth was Timothy Leary really trying to push during the 50s and 60s? Aldous Huxley, who was a huge user of LSD, as a matter of fact, when he died, or as he was dying, he had his wife shoot him up with LSD to help facilitate his way out. And Aldous Huxley said, the role of drugs in the exercise of political control is also coming under increasing discussion. Control can be through prohibition or supply. The total or even partial prohibition of drugs gives the government considerable leverage for other types of control. An example would be the selective application of drug laws permitting immediate search or no-knock entry against selected components of the population, such as members of certain minority groups or political organizations. But a government could also supply drugs to help control a population. This method was foreseen in Brave New World, which is a fantastic book, but let's not get it twisted that Aldous Huxley was just a great dude. He was connected to all these people behind the scenes in governments and the occult. He's just letting you know in a fictionalized form what's going to happen in the future. And as a matter of fact, the CIA declassified documents on the Monroe Institute's Gateway Experience and Consciousness detailed how in-depth the agency is interested in altered states of consciousness. So this goes into that part I was telling you about Crowley not only experimenting on people with peyote mescaline to see how you can use mind control on people, but also altered states of consciousness, connection to these praetor humans. CIA said they want to know how it works in the brain, outlining a gateway process to sync up both hemispheres of the brain, like high levels of meditation and drug use. When you tap into this, you tap into the endless flow of knowledge and energy to evolve spiritually or ascend. It's coming out of the CIA's mouth about MKUltra. It's one of their biggest goals, how to ascend, how to connect to off-world intelligence to receive the download. Page 28 of the Gateway Experience document says, encourage pursuit of self-knowledge. Be intellectually prepared to react to possible encounters with intelligent, non-corporal energy forms. Boom. So now we got it full circle with Crowley. He was doing it all. And all these people in MKUltra are connected to the ideas and experiments that Crowley was doing in the early 1900s. Leary even said in interviews that he believes in Gnosticism and the Shekinah of viewing God as a divine feminine and saying the knowledge set mankind free and that she wanted us to eat from the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Gnosticism 101, right? Everything's inverted with Gnosticism. And by the way, Shekinah, for people that don't know, it means dwelling or residence in Hebrew. And it's a concept in Judaism referring to the divine presence or glory of God. That's the biblical and Hebrew real meaning, right? But in Kabbalah, the connection between the Shekinah and femininity emerged in Jewish mystical literature, particularly the Kabbalah, where Shekinah is often identified as divine feminine, the lowest of the 10 Sephirot. So this ties into Sophia, who in Gnosticism is a feminine figure. And it's analogous to the human soul, but also simultaneously one of the feminine aspects of God. So according to Gnosticism, you've got a feminine, a divine feminine, this Sophia. This is in the Pleroma. This is with the monad. This is that highest level. And Gnostics also held that Sophia, Syzygy, or female twin of Jesus, the bride of Christ and the Holy Spirit of the Trinity, which I found interesting. When they say that this divine feminine is the Holy Spirit, what have we been hearing about Hathor, who was a major goddess in ancient Egyptian religion who played a wide variety of roles? She was a sky deity, was the consort of the sky god Horus and the sun god Ra. Again, the divine feminine, Hathor. I believe Hathor and Sophia are the one and the same. And we know that there is a guy right out there right now that says that he's in contact with Hathor, and he's going to help you get in contact with her too. And none of this is biblical. None of this is right. But these Gnostics, these people who believe that this is the correct way, just like Crowley, just like Timothy Leary, they're all leading you down a dangerous, deceptive path. And Leary had a huge disdain for God of the Bible. He said that God just wants the world on its knees for him. The best way to control the opposition is to lead it ourselves. So let's trick. I've been saying this. It's coming out of these guys' mouths. Let's infiltrate Christianity. Let's deceive people from within. It's what they do. And then they make this other side of it super attractive. Come over here and meet Hathor, meet the divine feminine, meet these entities, these predator humans, these secret chiefs. They'll give you what you need. They'll give you the download. And they do. I'm not saying that they're not delivering on that, but man, it's leading you down a dangerous, dangerous path. Part of this spiritual development that Leary wanted for America was one of controlling the public behavior and subverting them to choose immoral and evil things over the traditional culture, which had sustained under the guise of freedom while only being spiritual slavery. So again, this counterculture movement was actually enslaving people. So to tie Leary directly into the CIA one more time, he did a interview with W.H. Boart of Constantine Report, and this was posted up in 2009, and he asked Leary, do you think CIA people were involved in your group in the 60s? Leary said, of course they were. I would say that 80% of my movements, 80% of the decisions I made were suggested to me by the CIA. He said, I like the CIA. The game they're playing is better than the FBI, better than the Saigon police, better than Franco's police, better than the Israeli police. They're 1,000 times better than the KGB. So it comes down to who are you going to work for, the Yankees or the Dodgers? Back to what I just said about Crowley and Leary and many of these guys, they got their own agendas, but they're willing to work with these governments so they can continue doing the things that they want to do to achieve the enlightenment they're trying to achieve. Yeah, we'll do this. We don't have morals anyway. Yeah. We want to experiment on people. We'll lead them down the wrong path, sacrifice them, whatever. We'll do it to achieve our goal. So Boer actually says to Leary that based on some of the documents he had read, it seemed that he could have been one of the scientists who had been used without his knowledge by the CIA to conduct their mind control experiments. Leary said, I've known this for 10 years. And Boer says, you were witting of it? He said, of course. So Barrett says, you were wittingly used by the CIA during the 60s. You knew you were being used by the CIA. And Leary says, wait, when you say CIA, it's like saying the N-word, meaning that you're saying it in a very detestable way. Leary says, I knew I was being used by the intelligence agents of this country. Boert says, what were you doing for them? What were you doing? Did they want you to turn the kids on, huh? Were they trying to make the kids see God and leave the Vietnam War alone? Leary says, Walter, are you starting off into nationalism? Boert says, I'm asking you, what's the CIA's motive? What were you used for? Leary said, the CIA recognized what you probably haven't recognized yet, that I'm a very important national asset. What can I say? So Leary's pretty arrogant, very much like Crowley. That's probably why he worshiped Crowley, probably why he wanted to follow in the footsteps of Crowley, probably because he knew behind the scenes what Crowley had been doing all those years ago. And that right there is the series in a nutshell. We have looked at every aspect of Crowley's involvement with peyote, and we have now brought it directly into MKUltra programming and all these other testings that were leading up to MKUltra. I believe wholeheartedly that Crowley was the hidden father of MKUltra programming. He was one of the first Europeans to ever get a hold of peyote. We know that for a fact. We know that he was doing experiments behind the scenes from this mysterious cactus that he was going to write. It never was released, but it was 100 documents of experiments that he had done that was supposedly picked up by British Customs. But I believe that he handed them over, more than likely, to British intelligence, or they did snatch him up because he didn't want to give it to him. So in conclusion, I think that we can surmise from all the available data, if we want to suggest that Crowley was a secret agent, then he was for sure behind the scenes doing experiments with peyote, with mescaline on people and giving that data to secret intelligences. I don't think just British intelligence, if we're going to go to the extent of Crowley is a man who's out for himself. And I do think that part of these experiments were contact with predator humans or these off-world intelligence. And we know this directly from the Gateway Experience documents from MKUltra, where they said that when you go into this state, Be ready for possible encounters with intelligent, non-corporeal energy forms. And I think that's ultimately their main goal. Yeah, brainwashing is great. Mind control is great. Breaking a human down, building them up, turning into a Manchurian candidate is great. But it's better when you can contact the entities that can give you insight into building a nation the way that these governments think they should. Guys, I had a blast doing this. This was a wild three-parter. Haven't done a two, three, four-parter in a while. And I knew that for me to do this subject justice, I would have to break it down into three parts. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I love doing these deep dives when I can. Guys, if you can, if you enjoyed the show, if you just enjoy the show, please go give a five-star review. Go to Spotify, give a five-star review. Go to Apple, write a review, then give a five-star review. It helps the show grow. I don't know if I can express to you guys how much that it helps the show grow, but it does. Please go do that if you can, if you enjoy the show. I appreciate all the people who have already done it. Thank you so much. On the way out, we're going to listen to Head in the Clouds. You know what it is, guys. Go outside, touch grass, and get your tail out the hole.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Ryan Seacrest here. When you have a busy schedule, it's important to maximize your downtime. One of the best ways to do that is by going to ChumbaCasino.com. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino games like spin slots, bingo, and solitaire that you can play for free for a chance to redeem some serious prizes. So hop on to ChumbaCasino.com now and live the Chumba life. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They're also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.